Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Calling him a skilled diplomat and tireless defender of the nation's values, President Bush today skipped over the stalled Senate nominating process and named John Bolton U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. President Bush made the temporary recess appointment just days after Congress went on its annual summer break.
This post is too important to leave vacant any longer, especially during a war and a vital debate about U.N. reform. So today I've used my constitutional authority to appoint John Bolton to serve as America's ambassador to the United Nations.
But Democrats who've held up Bolton's nomination for months say that he's damaged goods because he now goes to the U.N. without the full support of the Senate, which has twice failed to muster the votes to confirm him. Joining us on the line from Washington is Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Holly, today's recess appointment means that Bolton can serve as U.N. ambassador until January 2007, when a new Congress is sworn in. What else is the White House saying about the appointment? Why now?
Essentially, John Bolton, they're installing him because they didn't feel he could get an up or down vote in the Senate, and plus they felt that the post had been vacant for way too long. There's an anniversary coming up for the UN and several important meetings, so they wanted to have someone in the post there in New York.
Well, Bolton has been under scrutiny for months about allegations that he mistreated subordinates, twisted pre-war intelligence to fit his policy goals. By the way, were any of those criticisms ever proven?
It's really hard to say. Democrats have a lot of testimony from people that worked with John Bolton over at the State Department, people that have said, you know, that he yelled at them and mistreated them. And they also have this new revelation from last week that he wasn't exactly forthcoming about talking to investigators who are looking into twisted intelligence. There are a lot of complaints about John Bolton. Some of them, you know, haven't exactly been proven, but enough concerns out there.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about last week's revelations. The State Department had to come out with an embarrassing reversal. John Bolton had said that he hadn't testified in an investigation into false intelligence regarding Africa, and also an investigation that also included the leak of the name of CIA agent Valerie Plame. In fact, he did testify in some form. That news did not seem to deter the White House.
Right, it didn't. I mean, the White House said that this was an honest oversight by Mr. Bolton, and that they were the ones that, upon discovering it, immediately brought it to the forefront. The fact is, it increasingly looked, as I said, that he would not get a vote in the Senate, and they felt that the post was vacant for way too long. And so it wasn't really a surprise that they went forward today on his nomination.
Yeah. It's not just Democrats who are opposed to John Bolton. Republican Senator George Voinovich of Ohio, as we remember, refused to support Bolton's nomination. Senator Trent Lott has said he thinks the recess appointment now is a bad thing for President Bush to do because it's a little bit of thumbing of the nose at the Senate, according to Trent Lott. So given that, how difficult is it going to be for John Bolton to do his job?
I don't know if it's going to be extremely difficult for John Bolton to do his job. I think what the real issue is how this is going to affect the White House's relationship with Senate Democrats on basically the eve of a debate over the Supreme Court nomination of John Roberts. Mm-hmm. That was what some had been concerned about last week at the White House, essentially whether this would sour the relationship with Democrats, if this might prompt him to go after John Roberts a little more than what they had planned to do, especially over memos related to his time in the White House and his time as Solicitor General. Mm. So that I think that's really going to be the effect, is what will the relationship be with the White House and Democrats now.
And of course, we want to say again that President Bush, as he said, is perfectly within his constitutional rights to make a recess appointment. But further with John Bolton, he was famously known to have said that you could lop 10 floors off the UN building in New York and it wouldn't make a difference. How is he going to be received at the UN?
It's really hard to say. I mean, a lot of ambassadors there were sort of silent a little bit during the debate over his nomination. And John Bolton himself sort of backtracked a little bit and said, maybe I shouldn't have made such strong remarks. But at the same time today, he said he wanted to go in and have, you know, agile reform, make sure that we can conquer these wars.
And by the way, what do you think he meant by agile reform?
There are still concerns that the UN isn't acting as quickly or forcefully as maybe it should.
Holly Bailey, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Holly, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We ordinarily spend our time in the here and now, but today we're taking a few minutes to peer into the future with Ray Kurzweil. Kurzweil invented the first print-to-speech reading machine for the blind and the first music synthesizer. In the late 80s, he predicted a worldwide computer network, the dominance of intelligent weapons in warfare, and the defeat of a human chess champion by a computer. So, when Kurzweil speaks, people listen. And now he's saying that in the near future, cell-sized robots called nanobots will travel our bloodstreams making repairs, part of a trend toward achieving immortality through technology. Kurzweil's new book, out next month, is called The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. And he joins us in the studio for a preview. Welcome.
Delighted to be with you, Robin.
What is the singularity you've been speaking of?
Well, we are the species that seeks to go beyond our limitations. I mean, that's really the unique thing about humans. And biology actually is very limiting. Our interneuronal connections, for example, think at chemical switching speeds of a few hundred feet per second, and electronics is already a million times faster. And ultimately, we're going to get very intimate with our technology. We're already putting things in our pockets. We'll have computers in our clothing in a few years. And as we get to the 2020s, intelligent nanobots, robots the size of blood cells, will make their way into our bloodstream. They'll keep us healthy by destroying pathogens, removing debris, correcting DNA errors. And they'll go into our brains and actually augment our thinking and actually expand our analytical capabilities.
Is this the same as transhumanism?
That's related. I actually don't like that word because, in my mind, we're not transcending our humanity. This is what it is to be human, is to go beyond our limitations. We're going to transcend our biology. So I prefer trans-biological. Mm. If it sounds very futuristic, I'd point out a couple of early examples. We're already putting blood cell-sized devices in the bloodstream of animals and curing major diseases. One scientist actually cured type 1 diabetes with that type of device. Very cleverly lets out insulin in a controlled fashion and so on.
I just want to be careful with that because when you say cure, you have to live with the device because in type 1 diabetes, you can't produce insulin, so the device does?
Right, but it becomes part of that animal. I mean, it's traveling in their bloodstream. So these are early experiments today, but by the 2020s, these will be routine technologies. We have neural implants, computers inside people's brains that allow you to actually download new software to your neural implant from outside the patient. This is an FDA-approved neural implant for Parkinson's disease. So this is technology we have today. You can't introduce that through the bloodstream. That requires surgical implementation, but that's today's technology. If we go out to the 2020s, we will be able to introduce these various advanced technologies non-invasively through the bloodstream and really extend our physical and mental capabilities.
And one of the reasons you and others believe so that this is going to happen is because of how technology has exponentially exploded.
Right, and this is not a casual observation of mine. I became an ardent student of technology trends because of my interest in being an inventor, and I realized most technology projects fail because the timing is wrong. And I've built mathematical models of how technology evolves. I have a team of 10 people that gathers data on key measures of many different technologies and many different aspects of technology, not just computers, are growing exponentially. For example, the cost of sequencing a base pair of DNA comes down by half every year. The amount of DNA data we collect doubles every year. It took us 15 years to sequence HIV. We sequenced SARS in 31 days, and there are hundreds of examples like that. And people say, well, you know, you can't predict the future. Turns out there are certain things that you can predict very reliably.
So what are you saying, Ray Kurzweil, again, getting back to the singularity? What are you saying that that means? You said it doesn't mean transcending humanity. It's still a human, but what, completely mind-melded with technology?
Essentially. Technology is growing by a factor of 1,000 every decade. Within 25 years, it'll be almost a billion-fold increase in the power of these electronic technologies as well as biological technology. We're reverse engineering our biology. The old drug paradigm was to just find something that happened to work and it had all kinds of side effects. We're now actually understanding the information processes underlying our biology and gaining the means to reprogram them. We have 23,000 little software programs called genes inside us, And conditions are different today. So one gene, for example, the fat insulin receptor gene, says hold on to every calorie because the next hunting season may not work out so well. That was a great program 30,000 years ago when calories were few and far between. We'd like to turn that off. What happens if you turn that off? Well, we have a new technology called RNA interference, which allows us actually to turn selectively genes off. When that gene was turned off in mice, these mice ate ravenously and remained slim and got the health benefits of being slim and lived 20% longer. And that's just one of the 23,000 genes that we could reprogram as we're actually gaining the means of essentially reprogramming our biology.
Right. You're saying, in essence, we could download a new software gene program into our bodies and have our genes respond in a different way.
There's two overlapping revolutions. One is the biotechnology revolution, where we're gaining the means through these types of drugs, RNA interference, to turn off specific genes, gene therapy, where we'll be able to add new genetic information, the ability to suppress enzymes, and really reprogram these information processes based on these biological processes. The other is nanotechnology, where we'll be able to put these little robots, nanorobots the size of blood cells, into our bloodstream. They'll go inside our body and carry out sort of complex missions to enhance our health. Mm. So whatever, and that's a little bit later. So whatever we don't get around to fixing with biotechnology, the nanobots, nanotechnology, will be able to repair.
Well, Ray Kurzweil, as you know, there are some people who think that this thinking is just wacko. And I know you know that. A bioethics professor at Yale, Sherwin Newland, I'll paraphrase what he says. He says that people like you who make these kinds of statements are brilliant people who don't want to die, that it distorts your rational thinking because you so much want to live and be immortal.
My predictions are not based on fantasy or desire. They're based on sort of rational examination of where these trends are headed. Mm. We'll have very detailed models of all the information processes underlying our biology within 10 to 15 years and the means of reprogramming them to stop and slow down and even reverse aging and disease processes.
Well, in fact, you talk about bridges, three bridges to immortality, or as you will, to slowing down the aging process. The first, a health regimen, which you yourself undertook when you were diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. This is the one more associated with lifestyle.
That's right. I mean, I cured my type 2 diabetes through lifestyle, nutrition, nutritional supplements. You really can.
Wait, nutritional supplements, how many a day?
I take about 200 a day.
And what is your goal? To be able to live long enough to see this singularity come true?
Among other things. I mean, the regime I'm following is we call Bridge 1, which is to slow down aging processes, overcome your genetic predispositions to disease, which you really can. The whole purpose of Bridge 1 is really just to be in good shape 10 or 15 years from now when we have the sort of full blossoming of this biotechnology revolution. And that's Bridge 2, which will bring us to Bridge 3 20 years from now, the nanotechnology revolution, nanorobots going inside our bloodstream, mm-hmm. which really will be able to provide sort of radical life extension, dramatic increases in our longevity.
Boston-based inventor Ray Kurzweil. When we come back, what about overpopulation if people live much longer? And what role does God play if we achieve immortality? Stay there. Much more with Ray Kurzweil just ahead on Here and Now. We've been talking with Ray Kurzweil, whose many books include The Age of Intelligence Machines, The Age of Spiritual Machines, A Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. His new work out next month is called The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. So, Ray Kurzweil, you've spoken of how this is going to happen, that we're going to have nanobots traveling in our bloodstreams, repairing us internally with software to repair our DNA. But as you all know, critics, including Francis Fukuyama, say, who's this we, that this technology will only be for the wealthy, will lead to even more of a divide between the haves and the have-nots.
Well, let me address that, because a key feature of this technology, which I call the law of accelerating returns, is really a 50% deflation per year. I mean, you can buy the same digital camera today as you could buy a year ago for half the price. These technologies, anything having to do with information, comes down by half each year. And it's true also of these medical technologies. AIDS drugs used to cost $30,000 per person per year. You can now buy them in Africa for $100 or $200 per person per year. Technology like this starts out unaffordable. Only the rich can afford them. And at that stage, they don't work. Then a few years later, they work a little bit better and they're merely very expensive. Then a few years go by, they're inexpensive and work quite well, and ultimately they're almost free, and then they work extremely well. And that is a 10-year progression from early adoption of unaffordable technologies that don't work to late adoption of really ubiquitous technologies. So we ultimately will be able to meet the physical needs of even an expanded human population, which increases in our longevity will create.
Well, sure, and that's the other question. I mean, you say expanded populations, but how you're talking about immortality. And well, still, already there aren't enough resources. So,
right, but there are nano-engineered designs already for solar panels that would be very efficient, lightweight, and inexpensive. If we captured 0.03% of the sunlight that falls on the Earth, we can meet our projected energy needs for the year 2030. And then we can store that energy in nano-engineered fuel cells, which will be highly decentralized, sort of get away from these centralized technologies like liquid natural gas tankers and atomic energy plants. So we'll be able to ultimately meet our energy needs very inexpensively through these renewable resources.
In your last book, I mentioned A Fantastic Voyage. You and your co-author write about the need for this thinking almost as if it's some sort of moral imperative that you want to save lives. Where does God fit into that equation and the idea that life is an arc and that death is a part of life in many faiths?
Well, death may be natural, but not all natural things are good. And in my view, death is a tragedy. It's a tremendous loss of personality, skills, knowledge, relationships. We've rationalized it as a good thing because that's really been the only alternative we've had. But we'd really have the opportunity to go beyond our limitations, overcome suffering. I think it is a moral imperative to overcome suffering.
Do you believe in God? I just wonder about that.
Well, I think evolution, which I talk a lot about in The Singularity Is Near, you can view as a spiritual process. Because what happens when systems of energy and matter evolve? If we look at biological evolution and technological evolution, they become more complex. Systems become more knowledgeable. They actually become much more intricate and more beautiful. They become more capable of higher emotions like love. So they grow exponentially in beauty, love, knowledge, intelligence, creativity, all of the things that people ascribe to God. I mean, God is a word. What does it mean? It means an unlimited amount of these things, creativity, intelligence, love. Well, evolution ultimately provides that by growing exponentially in just these kind of qualities that we attribute to God. So that's a spiritual perspective on the idea of evolution.
I think it's time for the lightning round. I was speaking to Ray Kurzweil, who has predicted so many things in the past that have since come true. So we want to take a look at the future with you. What do you see as the future of personal computers?
We have information processes inside our bodies and brains. Something I talk about extensively in The Singularity Is Near is reverse engineering the brain, understanding how it works. And ultimately, we'll be able to replicate them and create very human-like machines that are non-biological.
Oh, you get to that God question again. You know,
It brings up the other issue of spirituality, which is, what is the ultimate sort of spiritual value is consciousness. Right now, we can distinguish machines from humans because even if a machine pretends to be a human, let's say in a video game, the simulation is brittle. It doesn't have all the convincing, subtle cues of real human intelligence. But that distinction is going to go away as we get to 2030. There won't be a clear distinction between non-biological intelligence and biological intelligence.
What do you see as the future of music?
Well, we're creating cybernetic musicians that will be able to jam with you, musicians that understand your style and jazz or rock or whatever, and accompany you, compute the right walking bass line and drum accompaniments.
What do you see in travel?
Well, the biggest thing in travel is the ability to travel virtually. I'm actually the only speaker in the world that has this three-dimensional virtual reality technology. It's called Teleportech, where I can appear three-dimensionally at another venue. We have to send out a technician with the other end of the equipment, which looks like a podium, and it looks to the audience like I'm standing behind a podium. But I look three-dimensional. I look life-size. It's full immersion. It's quite realistic. Yeah, I've got this installed in my office.
Are you really here?
I'm really here. people have been convinced I was really there, and I can see them as well. As we get to the early part of the next decade, 2010, 2012, this will be a routine part of our cell phone, except the phone won't be a physical object. We'll be writing images directly to our retinas from our eyeglasses and lenses, which will create full immersion virtual reality. So the kind of experience you and I are having now, where we can look at each other and look around each other, we'll just be able to do with images written directly to our retina, but it'll feel like we're together, at least as far as visual and auditory virtual reality is concerned.
Mm. Ray Kurzweil, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. So we'll check back in 25 years?
Yeah, it's a date.
Scientist, thinker, entrepreneur, author Ray Kurzweil, his new book is called The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. He must be so much fun at cocktail parties. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, from the future of technology to the future of classical music, critic Lloyd Schwartz says he's seen it in Venezuela, a country of 25 million people that spends $29 million a year on orchestras for kids. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. A new study claims that a growing number of children are getting sick at school because of pesticides. The Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA, published the study last week. It shows that pesticides being used in or near schools caused more than 2,500 illnesses over 5 years. That's around 7.4 cases per million children. Well, Dr. Jeffrey Calvert is a co-author of the study. Dr. Calvert, the number of children who get sick from pesticide exposure, at least according to your study, seems small. But some parents will be alarmed that there are any, and you say the number is increasing?
We did see an increase among the children between 1998 and 2002. But as you mentioned, we are talking about low rates on the order of 6 to 8 per million.
How are these pesticides reaching kids in school?
Pesticides that are actually used at the school, either for control of insects or control of undesirable plants like weeds.
Mm-hmm.
The other route is when schools are located next to farms, and pesticides that are applied to the farms are drifting over to the schools.
Are these schools where people are not following regulations and law in applying pesticides?
In some instances, it's because the pesticides are not being applied according to the pesticide label. In other situations, it's because the people who were applying the pesticides were inexperienced and didn't know how to handle the pesticides. And in addition, pesticides, when they're registered, they have to prove that they pose no unreasonable risks. So that doesn't mean that a pesticide has to be risk-free. As a society, we tolerate a certain number of people are going to get sick from these pesticides. So even when they're used appropriately, in some situations, people are going to get sick from the pesticides.
Well, you also write in the report that there's a lack of involvement on the part of stakeholders. And by that, you mean parents and school staff. And I'm sure there are some parents listening who have made their homes entirely pesticide-free and didn't stop to think that the kids might be going to schools where pesticides are used.
That's a good point. It's important for parents to find out what the pesticide use policy is at their schools, and to find out if their school has an integrated pest management program whereby pests are controlled with chemicals as a last resort, and what they do instead to control pests is use non-chemical means.
By the way, what sort of federal or state laws are there regulating pesticide use at schools?
There are no federal laws that regulate pesticide exposures at schools. There's approximately 18 states that have regulations with respect to pesticide use at schools.
And we know that 7 states restrict pesticide application in areas neighboring a school. Well, how do you know someone's become sick because of pesticides? What are the symptoms?
The symptoms are nonspecific. So the symptoms can masquerade as upper respiratory infection or a stomach infection or just a typical skin rash. Usually the health effects that are produced by pesticides are not any different than health effects that you observe with many other types of illnesses. So to distinguish between a pesticide-related illness and an illness caused by something else, you have to get a history that the person was exposed to pesticides.
Well, you know, in fact, critics of your study say you got your statistics from other sources, poison centers, etc., and that you can't know for sure if the people who reported these symptoms actually suffered from pesticide poisoning. They didn't have blood tests or such.
That argument is true. We collect information on the health effects that the individual experienced, as well as information on what pesticide they were exposed to, and we determine whether or not that pesticide exposure could produce those types of health effects. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then we consider that a case of pesticide poisoning.
On the other hand, I'm thinking that not everybody walking around with conjunctivitis or respiratory tract illness is thinking pesticide. So, in fact, there may be a much larger number of people who are suffering illnesses who don't know it's related to pesticides?
That's correct. In many schools, students and staff are not informed when pesticides are applied. So individuals really often have no knowledge about whether or not they've been exposed to pesticides at their schools.
Hmm. Well, so Dr. Calvert, you have said you don't want to alarm people, but you want people to pay attention to this issue. What do you want them to do? What should be done?
We think that schools should adopt integrated pest management programs. That means that you control pests using non-chemical means, and you use pesticides only as a last resort if those non-chemical means don't work. Mm-hmm. So this means things like making sure the kitchen is clean, that food is kept in specified areas and not allowed throughout the school, that there are no cracks and crevices that would allow the pests to enter into the school. In addition, the pesticides on farms should be applied when the school is not in session, for example, on the weekends or on holidays. Mm-hmm. And we also recommend non-spray buffer zones. And those buffer zones range from 300 meters to about 2.5 miles.
Dr. Jeffrey Calvert is co-author of the study on pesticide exposure at schools. Doctor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We now turn to Jay Vroom. He's president of Crop Life America. And Jay, your organization represents suppliers of farming pesticides. What was your take on this study?
I think that some of the way the article is characterized and presented attempts to gain additional attention and could be viewed as alarmist. However, when you really peel back the rhetoric, the facts are actually quite reassuring that the number of exposures is a very low level.
But as we just heard, there are some who feel that, in fact, it may be a low number because most people wouldn't know to report that they're sick and connected with pesticide, that, in fact, there may be many more children who are getting sick from pesticides at school. And there are some parents who would say not one child should get sick from pesticides
sure.
at school. What are your thoughts?
Well, our industry certainly would agree with the notion that one sickness or illness is too many. However, we think it's important to reiterate the very important benefits of the use of pesticides in and around schools to control pests that might convey disease or other illness. And if you add all of those benefits together, we think that compared to virtually any other bit of technology that's in use in schools, that the risk-benefit ratio for the use of pesticides is an overwhelming success story.
Well, but in fact, according to the report, there is a lack of regulation, and that's a cause of pesticide exposure.
To be alarmist and say that there are an inadequate number of local or state regulations really overlooks the fact that the federal government has enormous resources and competency dedicated in this area already.
Well, what about protecting kids from this drift from farms? Last May, about 600 kids and staff members were evacuated from a school in Edinburgh, Texas, after pesticides that were being sprayed on a cotton field drifted, you know, on the wind into the school's air conditioning, and 30 kids got sick. What do you think about the idea of buffer zones between schools and farms?
In those cases where agricultural land is immediately adjacent to a school, we do think that it is very reasonable to ask operators to not spray too close to schools. Mm-hmm. And we believe that EPA currently has the authority to enforce that kind of safety measure, and that, again, the incidents are very minimal, but one incident is certainly too many.
Jay Vroom is president of Crop Life America. It's an organization that represents suppliers of farming pesticides. We also spoke earlier with Dr. Jeffrey Calvert, co-author of a study on pesticide exposure at schools. Jay Vroom, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And still to come, he made Boston's Blue Bloods blush in the early 1900s. So how risque is the work of French artist Edgar Degas in the 21st century? That's ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. How is Saudi Arabia reacting to the death of its leader, King Fahd. At over 80 years old, the king had ruled for 23 years, but 81-year-old Crown Prince Abdullah, who will ascend to the throne this Wednesday, had already become the de facto ruler of the kingdom. So who else moves up, and what does it mean? Patrick Lang is former head of Middle Eastern Affairs for the Defense Intelligence Agency and a former defense attaché stationed in Riyadh. He joins us from Alexandria, Virginia. And Patrick, what are the immediate ramifications of King Fahd's death? He was a very old man who, after suffering a stroke, had not been ruling the kingdom for the last 10 years.
Yeah, I really don't think there are very many immediate ramifications at all. His death does not represent the passing of a generation, because his younger half-brother, Abdullah, who now has become king, is not really much younger than he is, and they're of the same generation. They're the sons of the founders, the founder of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz, who captured the old fort in Riyadh in 1903, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And these gentlemen, they go back almost that far. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, you know, this is not a big deal, and the present king has been running the country now for a long time. We can hardly remember what it was like to deal with King Fahd in person.
Well, does this open up some possibilities at the bottom, maybe, of the rungs of the ladder to the throne?
In this country, in that country, just as in many Arabian countries, even places with written constitutions like Jordan, the succession to the throne is really decided not from father to son or anything like that, but on the basis of consensus, which is the usual traditional Arab ways of doing things. And, you know, there are thousands of possibilities of people of the royal blood there who could be placed on the route to succession. And the youngest kind of person that I could imagine who would be made third in succession after Sultan would probably be someone in his 60s, actually.
Yeah. Well, the 81-year-old Crown Prince Abdullah, who, as we said, will now become king, has been waging what we hear is and we know is an unprecedented reform drive. This has already been underway. How is he expected to continue that now that he's king?
Well, he will just go on with what he's doing. And reform, of course, mentioned with regard to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, is a really relative thing. Mm-hmm. The kind of things that we would think of as being reform are really almost unthinkable for them. Really basic changes in the status of women, having a written constitution, having some sort of freedom of religion in the country, things of that kind, are just not on the horizon for people in the royal family, because they know there's a very large internal population who are or might be described as pietists in the Wahhabi sect of Islam, and they and their clergy are dangerous people, and so the royal family has to be careful and try to balance interests.
Culturally, just a quick thought. Again, King Fahd had been ill for a while, 82-ish mm-hmm. years of age. How are the people of Saudi Arabia likely to react?
Well, they won't react at all. There isn't the kind of close identification outside the court circle with the king in Saudi Arabia that you might have in other places. For example, in Jordan, when King Hussein was king, people, East Bankers especially, came to really believe in him and love him, and especially the people of the Jordanian army. That kind of feeling doesn't really exist in Saudi Arabia, and indeed in the Wahhabi sect of Islam, the idea of lavishing that kind of affection on human beings who are going to their reward is thought of as something which is akin to shirk, which is associating too much with people, affections that should in fact belong to God.
And Patrick Lang, you who have observed the Saudi culture, when do you think younger people might become a part of the ruling family in Saudi Arabia? I mean, we see 80-year-olds, 70-year-olds stepping in. When do you think that's going to change?
It isn't going to change. Saudi society, as almost all Arab societies, run on the basis of family consensus in a particular group of people, and Arabs have a great respect for people of age. So the younger people's opinions are being taken into consideration now, but only gradually will they be brought into the highest positions in the country. They just don't operate that way.
Yeah. Patrick Lang, former head of Middle Eastern Affairs for the Defense Intelligence Agency, speaking to us from Virginia. Patrick, thank you.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now.
you can enjoy the view. And if you look down, that collection of bright lights going past is the city of Sydney. That looks like a beautiful, clear night down there.
That's astronaut Andy Thomas from inside the Space Shuttle Discovery, pointing out the view of his native Australia to fellow astronaut Steve Robinson outside the shuttle on a spacewalk. Robinson and Soichi Noguchi spent 5 hours on a spacewalk today to install a new gyroscope on the International Space Station. The gyroscope is used to help steer the space station. This comes a day after NASA officials said they may consider sending shuttle astronauts out during Wednesday's spacewalk to repair filler material dangling from Discovery's belly. Some engineers worry the material could trigger potentially dangerous, treacherous overheating during reentry. And in 24 years of shuttle flight, astronauts have never gone beneath their spacecraft in orbit and have made few repairs to their ship. But NASA officials stress that Discovery and crew could be perfectly safe flying back with the exposed filler. A new exhibit at Harvard University's Sackler Museum has been 100 years in the making. It features the work of French artist Edgar Degas, known as the master of drawing the human figure in motion. Harvard's first Degas exhibition was in 1911, and at that time, the show consisted of 12 borrowed pieces and raised eyebrows for what was considered questionable taste. Well, the new exhibit is opening today for 4 months, and it features 62 works from the university's collections, which include the artist's paintings, sculptures, prints, and photography. Here now is Kelly Jones, visits the museum to trace Degas' long history at Harvard.
The first time Degas came to Harvard, the show rocked Boston with its daring.
Well, it was daring.
Marjorie Cohn is Harvard's newly retired curator of prints.
The director of the time, Edward Forbes, really didn't want the show, but he was encouraged to have it because the attendance was very poor at the museums, and he was told correctly that modern art was what would interest people, and so they sucked it up, I guess you'd say, and dared to show a show by a living artist.
It wasn't just that Degas was still alive and that traditionally one had to be dead or an old master to have a show at the Fog. It was that his work was so alive, too.
Just a simple line could bring out a person's personality, whether it was a line of her back or the line of an arm, a gesture, whatever.
In 1874, Edmond de Goncourt, the prolific Parisian cultural critic, put it this way. He has set his heart on laundry girls and danseuses. Of all the men I have seen engaged in depicting modern life, he is the one who has most successfully rendered the inner nature of that life. Well, in 1911, the inner natures of lawn dresses, dancers, and nude women in the bath weren't exactly what some prim Bostonians wanted to see in a museum.
Ballet dancers were all considered prostitutes, and the bathers were all considered low-class women of some kind or other. They were not high-class. Cafe singers, even jockeys, you know, these were not distinguished middle-class subjects. People in Paris might not have felt that way. Early 20th century Boston, some of the Bostonians had a very hard time.
But like most cultural events that poke at delicate artistic and moral sensibilities, the Fog's 9.5 days of Degas were a hit. Impressionism was all the rage in Boston, and Harvard's leap into modern art was precedent-setting. It could claim another first, too. It was Degas' only solo show in the world during his lifetime. Not that anybody let the artist know.
We don't think Degas ever knew about it. We think he probably never heard of it, and he probably would not have approved. He was very cautious about permitting other people to exhibit his work.
Degas withheld his work from even French and English museums that came calling, but he was widely collected, and two of his most enthusiastic collectors and champions, a generation apart, were Harvard men. One of them, Denman Ross, was the inspiration behind Harvard's first Degas show. The other, Paul Sachs, graduated from Harvard in 1900 and returned in 1914 as the Fog's associate director. The current exhibition's co-curator, Stéphane Willehosian, says Sachs helped cement Degas' place at Harvard for decades to come.
It was really Sachs who had an incredible impact, not only on the reception of the artist's work in this country, but also in the collecting, just because of his own excitement in the artist's work. The collection as it's here is really very much one that has Sachs's imprint on it and really does come together because of Sachs's tremendous commitment to the artist.
In addition to Sachs' imprint, Harvard's current Degas collection also has 22 works that Sachs himself amassed. Harvard's Degas holdings, Marjorie Cohn says, continue to grow.
This show, although the acquisitions began decades and decades ago, includes at least 4 or 5 new acquisitions from this year, and including a major painting, a major drawing, one of his most important prints, were all given this year. So you can see that it's not the end of Degas at Harvard, that I hope at least in another 95 or 100 years there'll be another show that'll be twice as big.
It was Degas' legacy at Harvard that co-curators Stefan Wolohusian and Edward Saywell had in mind while putting together the current show. Edward Saywell.
I think the long history of Degas at the Fog did play a very important role in our thinking about the exhibition in terms of putting archival material into the exhibition to tell the story of the artist here.
Harvard's is a working collection, which means that students work with originals, not copies, on conservation projects and to trace provenance, for example. Saywell says that Degas at Harvard is as much of a learning laboratory as it is an exhibition.
All of us as curators had never had the opportunity to do this, to actually put out the drawings next to the paintings, next to the sculpture, to have a conversation, a dialogue between the photographs and the drawings in this way. To be able to bring together what is a small grouping, but one that can be so instructive for teaching, for the public, when they come in to really look at these media that they may not necessarily associate with Degas.
Works such as an abstract landscape monotype, flanked on one side by two of the only known existing landscape photographs that Degas ever took, and on the other by an early landscape drawing and landscape print. A single wall at Degas at Harvard begins to tell the story of one man's evolution as an artist, and of one museum's evolution of a collection. In its totality, co-curator Wolohusian says, Degas at Harvard, with its ballet dancers, horsemen, landscapes, bathers, and more, offers a rare, all-encompassing look at an artist who defied characterization and was obsessed with pushing the limits of any given medium.
I think he is alone in that way, especially if you consider him in the limited context of the artists we usually identify as the Impressionists, to work in so many different media and to be so innovative in all of them.
Which kind of puts the lie to Edmond de Goncourt's pessimistic conclusion to his otherwise fawning assessment of Degas' work. One wonders, the 19th century critic wrote, whether he will ever produce something really complete. I doubt it. He seems to have a very restless mind.
That's Here and Now's Kelly Jones. For more information about the exhibition Degas at Harvard and links to the works in the show, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.